We still don't have that buzzer in like I wanted, but that'll come in time. I know it will. Thank you, Robert. Good evening. Good evening. Thank you for good evening me. That was Eric. I knew it was. I can count on Eric to good evening me and to laugh at my jokes. That's two important things to any preacher. You know what I mean? Hey, Faith, how are you doing?
Good.
Have you had any ice cream yet tonight?
Yep.
Yes. She can't talk to me with your hand over her mouth. I mean, if you're going to turn to Acts 18, if you'd like to. Ben's not here tonight. Wendy said a couple of the boys were sick, and so Ben stayed home with them. I wanted to give Ben some grief, but not really Ben. Just, you know, we do the cards with kids singing. What's Acts 18 when we do kids sing? Y'all done forgot? I mean, I'm not going through 1 through 17. You just forget that. Aquila and Priscilla. All right. And I told Ben I thought of Paul in Corinth, because if Acts 17 is Paul in Athens, then Acts 18's got to be Paul in Corinth. But he just told me, like I said, to direct all complaints in writing to the Kids Sing Forum. So I'm not going to do that. Acts 18. The church in Corinth was established on Paul's second missionary journey. First missionary journey is Acts 13 and 14. Second journey starts in 1536 and goes down to 1823. So we're on the second missionary journey right now, sometime between AD 49 to 52. And if you'll notice, Paul stayed in Corinth for 18 months. So Acts 18, how long was Paul in Corinth? Same number as the chapter, 18 months. And that's longer than he stayed anywhere else, with a single exception of Ephesus. He stayed in Ephesus for 3 years, Corinth for a year and a half. But these 18 months are compressed into just 17 verses. So if you want to draw a line under verse 17, verses 1 through 17, it was Paul in Corinth, 18 months and 17 verses. So that averages out to not even a verse for every month that he was there. If we're going to understand about Paul in Corinth, I think it's pretty good to understand a little bit about the geography of Greece. I'm going to show you a picture of a map here. Greece is very nearly cut into by the sea, right? And the southern part of Greece, you see Macedonia there in the north, Achaia in the south. The southern part of Greece is nearly an island. Right, all that's left to join the two parts of Greece together is that narrow little isthmus right there. It's about 4 miles across, and it's on that narrow neck of land that Corinth was situated. Now, you can tell just by looking, all north-south traffic in Greece had to pass through Corinth. There was just no other way. So Corinth was a great commercial city. It was known for its luxury items, known for its wealth. But not only, and this is the kicker, this is what made Corinth such a great commercial center. Not only did all the north-south traffic have to pass through Corinth, most of the east-west traffic did as well. Because you'll notice the southern part of Greece here, the Peloponnese here, the very southern tip of Corinth, this is Cape Malea. Cape Malea. And the Greeks had a saying. It was a very dangerous little, we call it a promontory there, whatever you want to call it. The Greeks had a saying, let he that sails around Malea first make his will. It was that dangerous. And so what they would do is if, you know, the ship, here comes the ship down, instead of sailing around here, this would have been 202 miles, if it was a small ship, they would just stop right here and put it on rollers and roll it across if the boat was small enough. Just get it out, dock it, and put it on rollers. If the ship was too big, they would just stop here and they would take the cargo off, haul it across this narrow neck of land, and load it onto another ship. Right? And going across the little 4 mile strip here saved a trip of 202 miles. And so, like I said, you can see how Corinth, north, south, east, west in Greece, it's going to pass through Corinth. And I have, this is like a satellite-looking picture to me. This is, if you can't really see it there, but it's the Corinth Canal. All right, it wasn't present then. Nero, the Roman Emperor Nero, made a plan for it, started to try to dig it. He wasn't successful. The current canal used the plans that Nero drew up, so now you don't have to take your boat and put it on rollers. That's a relief, isn't it? Now you can just sail right on through there. But there was another side to Corinth as well, and it's probably what we think of when we hear Corinth. Corinth was known for, you know, wealth and luxury, but also for filth and debauchery. These are the ruins of the temple of Aphrodite. And, you know, in ancient times, if somebody from Corinth was depicted, if they were shown in a play, and the person in the play was supposed to be from Corinth, they would always portray them as being drunk. So if you're the guy from Corinth in the play, you're drunk, right? They had a saying, the Greeks had a lot of sayings apparently, but to Corinthianize, right, to become a Corinthian meant you're going in the wrong way. You know, you're doing things you ought not to do. These are the ruins, I think I said, the Temple of Aphrodite. Aphrodite was worshipped with 1,000 sacred priestesses who were nothing more than prostitutes. I mean, you can put the word sacred in front, I guess, if you want, but they were prostitutes who would come down into the city, come down into the streets of Corinth each evening, and they would ply their trade. And the sailors had a saying that's not every man who can afford a trip to Corinth. Just to give you an idea that Corinth, then, not only known for wealth, but also, like I said, for really indecency. Now, given this background that I've given you, who would guess, you know, who would think that in this city, this is where Paul would experience some of his greatest triumphs? You probably wouldn't pick Corinth. You know, Thessalonica, maybe, the gospel sounded forth from there, Berea, the noble Jews in Berea. Corinth, Paul claims some of his greatest achievements. I heard Wendell Winkler say, you know, if you had to pick a church in the New Testament, of all the churches that are mentioned, which church would you want to be a member of? Right? Philadelphia or Philippi, maybe, but not you. Corinth wouldn't be your first-round draft pick of the church you wanted to be a member of. Well, we're going to read about the establishment of the church in Corinth tonight. If you'll notice, we'll look at the first four verses here that talk about Aquila and Priscilla. When Paul left Athens, verse chapter 17, he's in Athens. He's going to travel now some 50 miles to the southwest. You see where Athens is. 50 miles from there, he's going to make his way to Corinth. They say the population of Corinth in New Testament times was around 300,000 free citizens, along with 460,000 slaves. So that's, what, over 750,000 people altogether. But Paul's first order of business when he came to Corinth was what? He had to establish a source of income, right? He had to find a way that he could support himself. The Jews always taught that if you didn't teach your son a trade, you were teaching him robbery, right? Work was very important to the Jews. And so, Paul was a tent maker, right? A leather worker, more than just maybe tents, literally. And that's how Paul happened to meet Aquila and Priscilla. And they were of the same occupation. Now, Mary Helen was so kind. Mary Helen went to school with them. And she had still on her phone a picture of Aquila and Priscilla. And I wanted to thank Mary Helen, for she emailed me that earlier today. Now, when Ben does kid sing now, Acts 18, the official answer is Aquila and Priscilla, and so I thought we need to sort of give them some attention then. This couple, these guys. But I mean, you need to have somebody in your mind when you think about them, and that they're just as good as any. They're mentioned six times in the New Testament, and there's actually a ton of information packed into those six brief verses. The husband's name was Aquila. I can never remember to think Aquila, Priscilla, but obviously I always think Priscilla Presley is how I remember. Priscilla's a girl's name. Aquila, the Latin Aquilus, it literally means eagle. So his name literally means the eagle. He was a Jew. He was from Pontus in Asia Minor. If you remember on Pentecost, there were people present from Pontus on that great day. His wife, and this I think is interesting, all right? His wife's proper name, her proper name was Prisca. Prisca. I said they're mentioned six times. Three of those times, it's Paul doing the writing. Of course, Paul didn't write Acts, that's Luke. But whenever Paul mentions her, Paul always calls her Prisca. And that literally means old. Means old. But what's interesting is whenever Luke mentions her in Acts, and Luke mentions her three times, Luke always, he never calls her Prisca. Luke always calls her Priscilla. You know how, like in language, there's diminutives? Like in Spanish, right, Erica, a burro is a donkey. And so a burrito is, you know, we think something like you put steak and sour cream in and you eat. But it literally means a little donkey, right? Burrito, right? Well, Priscilla is the diminutive of Prisca. So it takes whatever Prisca means and adds little to it. And so literally it means little old lady. And so, and I know you don't remember this, but I think in 2014, I think one of the first lessons I did here was called The Eagle, The Little Old Lady and the Eagle. And it was a narrative about Aquila and Priscilla. Of the six times that they're mentioned, four of the six times the wife is mentioned first. And that's kind of surprising. You know, you would think the husband would be mentioned first, but four out of the six, so that's two-thirds, she's mentioned first. Don't know why. I'm not sure the reason. Some, you know, people speculate and say, well, maybe she had a higher social standing. I don't know that that would lead them to mention her first. Maybe she was the more outgoing, the more dominant personality of the two. Maybe she was a Christian law. Nobody knows. It's just speculation. We're not told. But look at verse 2. In AD 49, the Roman Emperor Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome. And some 20,000 Jews had to relocate. You can put, that's pretty set historically. You could put a little note beside that verse, AD 49. And somehow, this couple, now I'm not saying this is as the crow flies. You can see they started off in Italy in Rome, and they made their way to Corinth. And I'm, you know, that's just a straight line distance there. But somehow, they ended up making their way to Corinth, which was over 600 miles. From Rome, and that's where Paul first met them on his second missionary journey. We don't know if they were already Christians while they were in Rome, or if they later became Christians while they were in Corinth. It may have been, if you look at verse 2, Paul may have converted them while they were in Corinth, because Aquila is described as a Jew. He's described as a Jew in verse 2, so Paul may have converted the couple. But at any rate, they invited Paul into their home, since they were of the same occupation. And that began a friendship that would last, you know, the rest of their lives. And what we're going to fast forward now just a minute and skip ahead. Because what I want to do is just trace, this is so fascinating to me. Because, you know, you think about couples in the Bible, Adam and Eve, you know, come to mind. I don't know how high up Aquila and Priscilla are on your list. But I want to trace this couple's movements and see just what kind of people they were. I think there's a lot to learn from them, even though they're not mentioned a whole lot. Paul stays in Corinth 18 months, and Paul leaves. When Paul leaves Corinth, he takes Aquila and Priscilla with him. And what he does, they sail across almost due east. They're going from left to right as we're looking at it here. They leave Corinth and sail across the Aegean Sea, 250 miles, and they came to Ephesus. Now, Ephesus wasn't in Greece. Ephesus is over in Turkey, or Asia Minor here. And they stayed in Ephesus even after Paul left. Because when Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, he sends them, they were still in Ephesus. He says, they send you greetings. 1 Corinthians 16:19, Aquila and Priscilla send you greetings. And along with the church that is in their house. All right, so they had a church meeting in their home. The church in their house. So they leave Corinth, they go to Ephesus, and in Ephesus, a congregation meets in their home. And that shows, by the way, the church is not a building, is it? The church in their house. And I've also heard preachers talk about, you don't hear this much today about, you know, there's some folks that think that you can't eat in a church building. You ever heard that idea? No eating in the building. I mean, if they couldn't eat in the building, they ate out all the time because their house was the building. The church met in their home. They have to go outside to eat and come back. I mean, that's silly. Now, after Claudius died in AD 54, his edict was no longer in effect, expelling the Jews. And so they went back home. They went back over 800 miles. They left Ephesus and went all the way back to Rome. How do we know that? Well, when Paul wrote the book of Romans, guess who the book of Romans was written to? The church in Rome, right? Well, in Romans chapter 16, Paul sends greetings. He greets like, I think it's 26 people by name. And guess who's at the first of the list when Paul sends greetings to the church in Rome? Greet Priscilla and Aquila. And he says, verse 5, Romans 16, 5, that a congregation was meeting in their house. But what's interesting, he says that this couple risked their own necks for his life. They risked their necks. They put their life on the line for Paul. So they weren't just Christians in name only. They put their faith in action. And it may be that it was in the riot that we read about next week in Acts chapter 19. But here's what's interesting. You know, you read in one book and you read in another, greet Priscilla and Aquila and the church that's in their house. And then you read it again and you think, oh yeah, I've read that before. But you don't realize, you know, automatically, no, this was two different places on at least two different occasions and in two different locations. And you see them here. They had congregations meeting in their house in Ephesus first, and then in Rome. And I think that's remarkable. And why it's interesting to me is that when you read about Aquila and Priscilla, you're not reading about an apostle and his wife. You're not reading about a preacher and his wife, a clergyman, a minister and his wife. We're reading about, in my quotation mark, an ordinary Christian couple who took their faith with them everywhere they went. Just in the journeys that we've traced, and I'm going to get ahead of myself. This is just the reverse. It's the same slide with a different starting and ending point. Because the last time we read about them is in Paul's last letter to Timothy, in 2 Timothy, AD 60-something, mid-60, 66, 68, Paul's decapitated. But he writes a letter to them, writes a letter to Timothy, and he sends greetings to them. They're back in Ephesus. So the 2 Timothy, Paul writes, they're back in Ephesus again. And chronologically, that's after he wrote Romans. And he sends them greetings. And so just in the journeys that we've traced, you know, they went from Rome there to Corinth, Corinth to Ephesus, Ephesus all the way back to Italy, and then back to Ephesus. That's over 2,500 miles. Which, that's a lot of travel, you think, for the first century. Makes me wonder if they weren't, you know, perhaps somewhat wealthy. I don't know how much passage on the boat cost. Maybe this was a wealthy couple. And then you think they had a congregation meeting in their home. They may have had a pretty big house as well. You just try to speculate on some things. But that's the lesson's not they were wealthy, and the lesson's not they sure did travel a lot. To me, the lesson is they care wherever they were Christians, right? You can be a Christian anywhere in the world, right? And they carried their faith with them, shared the gospel every step of the way. And I think that's worth pointing out. Maybe we ought to call it Aquila and Priscilla after all in Acts 18. But let's drop down to verse 5. At some point, Paul, or Silas and Timothy rather, arrived from Macedonia. So there's Macedonia. You remember Paul in Acts 17 had been waiting on them in Athens, and while Paul was waiting on them to show up in Athens, his spirit was stirred within him. Well, finally, at some point, Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, and they brought with them a contribution from the Macedonian brethren, maybe from the Philippian church, who loved Paul so much, and Paul loved them. And that contribution from them would have allowed Paul to spend less time tent making and more time preaching the gospel, because he was able then to devote himself to the teaching of the word, right? He was able to spend more time teaching, less time tent making. But as usual, you know what the Jews did. They stirred up trouble. And so Paul We're told that he went to the home of a man named Titus Justus. That doesn't mean, by the way, that he left Aquila and Priscilla's home. I think he stayed with them. I think he adjusted where he taught, because he had been in the synagogue. Right? Now, notice what he does. He had been in the synagogue. The Jews stirred up trouble for him, so he says, well, I won't be in the synagogue anymore. So where does he go instead? To a house right next door to the synagogue. Gotta love Paul. Right? Okay, I'll leave. He's next door now. So Titus Justus, and he is described as a Gentile who was also a worshiper of God. And that's who Paul appealed to in these synagogues, who he had his most success with. It wasn't usually the Jews. It was with the God-fearers like Cornelius. Remember Cornelius, a Gentile who feared God, and that's who he had his success with. And that's when the Jews would get angry because he was stealing their sheep for Christ, as I said. Titus Justus lived next door. His house, what does it say, joined fast to the synagogue. He lived next door. And Paul was likely using his house as a classroom. Crispus now was the synagogue ruler. Well, Paul converts him. He became a Christian. In fact, Crispus was one of the handful of people who could say, you know, I was personally baptized by Paul. Remember in 1 Corinthians, Paul says, I baptized Crispus and Gaius and the household of Stephanus and maybe some others. He said, I thank God I didn't baptize too many of y'all because you're such sectarians. You're infected with the party spirit. I'm of Paul. I'm of Apollos. I'm of Cephas. I'm of Christ. And Paul says, well, you're divided, though, and Jesus isn't divided. I'm thankful I didn't baptize too many of y'all, lest you would accuse me of baptizing in my own name. But at any rate, Crispus was one of those that he baptized. And not only Crispus, but Crispus' entire family became Christians. Look down to verse 8. Many of the Corinthians, here's the start of the Corinthian church, right? The church of God in Corinth. Many of the Corinthians hearing Paul believed and were baptized, right? Men and women. Wayne Jackson says right here in his commentary, it's just here that we see that Paul was as human as the rest of us. You read about Paul and you think he never had moments of weakness. He never had moments where he was afraid. This sudden growth, this influx of growth in Corinth made Paul nervous. It made him afraid, a little scared, because you can imagine what's happened everywhere he's been. In Philippi, right, he was put in prison. Thessalonica, he has to leave under cover of darkness. They run him out on a rail in Berea, and now I'm in Corinth, and now there's a sudden growth of the church, and you know what he's thinking? Well, the formula usually is, I have success, right, the gospel, but you know what I'm saying. And then the Jews come and harass us. And so Paul is scared. But during the night, one night, the Lord appeared to Paul in a vision. And he says to him, I think our English translations read, do not be afraid, right? Well, I don't know Greek very much, but I can read those who do. And those that know Greek say what Jesus said. And the Greek literally means, stop being afraid. In other words, he was afraid, and he was told, stop being afraid. Don't be afraid. Don't stop teaching the gospel. Keep on preaching the gospel. Notice verse 10. Jesus says, for I am with you, and nobody is going to set on you to harm you or attack you in this city, for I have many in this city who are my people. And that's interesting too, isn't it? Well, you know, does this mean the people who had already obeyed the gospel? Does this mean he had many people? And this is the interpretation that I guess I lean to. We have to be careful when you lean to something just because you like it. That's no reason. I have many people in this city who are mine in prospect. They're going to hear you teach. And when they hear you teach of their own free will, they're going to obey you. Your life's not going to end here. It's not going to end yet. I have many people in this city who need to hear the truth and obey it. And your preaching, the gospel, is going to lead them to the truth. I have many people in this city. Well, I like to think about that because that'll work even today, won't it? God has many people in Jacksonville who are his people, doesn't he? They're his people in prospect. That's the idea. They're not his yet in fact, but they're his in prospect. And when they hear the gospel and render obedience to it, they'll become his children. That's a motivating thought to me, even today. All right, now, while Paul stayed in Corinth, he wrote at least two of his New Testament epistles. You want to guess which two they were? Don't say 1 and 2 Corinthians. Brother Burton is right. Brother Burton wins a bowl of ice cream with Faith Tonight with chocolate on top, chocolate vanilla. 1 and 2 Thessalonians. 1 and 2 Thessalonians were written while Paul was in, they're thought to be the earliest of his epistles. If you're wondering, if you want to play bonus round, where were the books of Corinthians written from? Ephesus. All right, so that's kind of confusing. Corinthians, 1 and 2 Corinthians written from Ephesus. Thessalonians were written from Corinth. Now drop down to verse 12, the little 12 to 17 segment. During this time, a man named Gallio was the proconsul of Achaia. This is one of those instances where history gives us some insight. You can put beside this, this was the summer of AD 51. We know from a historical inscription, Gallio came to be proconsul of Achaia during the summer of AD 51. Well, Gallio was famous for his wit. Apparently he had a good sense of humor. He was famous for his kindness. His brother was Seneca. Seneca was the tutor of Nero, but Seneca, his brother, said about him that even those who love him to the utmost do not love him enough. So apparently he was a very good-natured person. But as soon as he came into office, you know what the Jews tried to do. They thought, we can prejudice him. If we can get to him first, we'll prejudice him against Paul, and then by extension, we'll prejudice him against the Christians, right? And so they grab Paul, they bring him before, it says, the judgment seat. The judgment seat, or the bema, was a raised platform where speakers would make their speeches and citizens are brought before the council. They charge Paul, this man, he's persuading others to worship contrary to the law. Now, what law did they mean? Law of Moses? Probably not. What would that have meant to a Roman official? Probably Roman law that they're talking about. And so Paul's about to speak up in his own defense. He's trying to get us to worship contrary to the law. Paul's about to speak up, but before Paul can speak out, Gallio speaks first. And Gallio says, look, if it were a matter of some great crime against the state that this man has committed, I would listen to your complaints. All right, if it was something he had done against Rome, I would give you an audience. But if it's just hair-splitting, nitpicking questions, as he would see it, concerning names and words. Now, what did he mean by that? Well, what was Paul teaching the Jews? Jesus is the Messiah, verse 2, or is it verse 5 and verse 28? I think it's 5. Paul's persuading them that the Christ was Jesus, right? They knew the Messiah is coming. Paul says, well, Jesus is the Christ. But to Gallio's ears, he's like, look, if it's those questions, names and words, Paul says, y'all need to, or Gallio says, y'all need to be the judge of that. I'm not interested in those matters. He cared for none of those things. Gallio's view was that I guess church issues ought to be kept out of civil court. That's not bad advice at all. Now here's the good part. It is almost certain that Gallio did not distinguish Christianity from Judaism, right? Most likely, Gallio just viewed Christianity as a sect, a denomination within Judaism, right? That's a good thing that he did. Why is that? Well, the upside to that was this. Once Gallio said, look, we're not going to be getting involved in these matters. I'm not going to rule on this. I'm not going to pronounce judgment against Paul. These are internal matters you Jews need to work on. Don't bring them before me. Well, guess what that did? That opened up the door now for Paul, with legal backing, to take the gospel all over the Roman Empire. And in fact, some scholars have speculated that God used Gallio providentially, unwittingly, we've seen that on other instances, to further his kingdom. Because now the doors are open, and Paul, without persecution from the authorities, can now spread the gospel. But Gallio drove them all from the judgment seat, and that made the Jews furious. So if they couldn't beat Paul, they wanted to beat Paul. If they couldn't beat Paul, they'll find the next person in line. And who do they grab? And this is interesting too. Sosthenes. Sosthenes is described as the ruler of the synagogue. Well, I thought Crispus was the ruler of the synagogue. Well, Paul's already baptized him. 1 Corinthians 1:4. Paul's already baptized Crispus. So Sosthenes most likely is the man who inherited that position when Crispus obeyed the gospel. Crispus isn't the ruler of the synagogue now. Now Sosthenes is. And notice verse 17, Luke says that they took Sosthenes and they beat him there before the tribunal. But Gallio's like, that's whatever you're going to do. I'm not interested in this. But now here's what's interesting. They beat Sosthenes. Apparently they were mad. Why are they mad at Sosthenes? Apparently they must have blamed him for not stopping Paul's preaching. Not saying they were being logical here. They were angry. They were furious. And they vented their frustrations. You could have stopped him, so they beat him. But this outburst of theirs backfired. Right? Why do I say that it backfired? Because Sosthenes became a Christian. How do you know that? You flip over to 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and look who's mentioned in the introduction. 1 Corinthians 1 verses 1 and 2. Paul, called to be an apostle by the will of God. And who? And our brother Sosthenes, unto the church of God that is in Corinth. Now, to be fair, you'll read that, and scholars will say, well, there was more than one person named Sosthenes, and so this is not certain that it's the same Sosthenes, easy for me to say, but I have to believe, there's a good probability that it was. Just putting all the circumstantial evidence together, I think you can make, especially given the location here, that this was the same Sosthenes that they took and beat. And just like Paul baptized Crispus, Paul had a role in converting Sosthenes. So what they meant for evil, God meant for good. Now drop down to verse 18. Paul now can temporarily relax because of this protection that Gallio's order has provided him. And he stayed in Corinth for many days, we're told, for a while. But finally, he and his friends, Aquila and Priscilla, decided to sail for Syria. They went to Ephesus. Paul made a vow. Paul had made a vow. I don't know what vow Paul made. Only vow I'm aware of, the Nazarite vow there in the Old Testament. But Paul had made some sort of vow, and he terminated that vow at Cenchrea. He had let his hair grow. And you can read about the Nazarite vow. They'd let their hair grow, and they'd cut that hair, they'd offer it to God. Well, Paul had made a vow, and he gets to Cenchrea, and he cuts his hair. I've read that this vow was showing his gratitude for God for his protection of Paul while he was in Corinth. That sounds reasonable to me. I don't know the answer to it. But they sailed due east across the Aegean Sea, and they came to Ephesus. Ephesus was the capital there of Asia Minor. Ephesus was the main city. It had a population of 200,000. It had a library. It had paved streets, beautiful paved streets it was known for. It had public baths. It had a theater. Paul did what he always does, and he went into the Jewish synagogue, and he reasoned there, reasoned with the people. And he must have made quite an impression, because what did they do? What did they say to him? They said, we want to have you back for a gospel meeting. We like you so much, right? We're going to have you on the summer series. They asked him to stay longer, but he politely declined. He said, if the Lord will, if the Lord will, I'll come back and I'll see you later. And he does. This first visit to Ephesus was a brief one. He's going to come back later and stay for 3 years. Now, Aquila and Priscilla, though, he left them behind. They stayed apparently at Paul's request there, because the text says he left them there. And so Paul then sailed from Ephesus, you can't see on the screen, sailed south, I guess, from Ephesus down to Palestine, which would have been a journey of more than 500 miles, because in verse 22, Luke says Paul went up, that's a geographical reference there, and greeted the church, probably the Jerusalem church. You always are going up when you're going to Jerusalem. But beginning in verse 23, you might make this note, we're starting the last missionary journey, all right? Chapters 13 and 14, first journey. 15, 36 to 18, 22, second journey. Picking up now with 18, 23, this is the start of the third journey. And you don't know how well this shows up here. Antioch is the mission base. This is the mission base where the journey is going to begin from. Because after he gets back here to home base, he's off again. And this time, he's on a campaign of 1,500 miles, but he doesn't have anybody with him. this time. You remember on the first journey, it was Paul and Barnabas. Then on the second journey, Paul and Barnabas split up, and Barnabas took John Mark, and Paul took Silas. Well, on the third journey, it's just Paul. You see him winding his way. He makes his way through the region of Galatia and Phrygia, or Phrygia, depending on what part of Alabama you're from. And he ends up making his way, winds his way back to Ephesus. And he stays in Ephesus for 3 years. Longest place he stays. Now, I mentioned that he left Aquila and Priscilla behind in Ephesus. And in Ephesus, Aquila and Priscilla are going to meet a very eloquent man named Apollos. Apollos was from Africa. He was a native of Alexandria, which was in Egypt on the northern coast of Africa. He was a great speaker, right? He's described as an eloquent man. He was competent in the scriptures. That means the Old Testament writing. So he was a good Bible student. Luke says he was very zealous. He was fervent in spirit. The word literally means, Brother Jackson points out, it means boiling. So he had zeal and knowledge. Competent in the scriptures. Very zealous. One drawback, he knew only the baptism. He taught accurately the things concerning Jesus, but he knew only the baptism of John. Some have speculated that being where he was from, he had not yet heard the news. He knew that Jesus was coming, the Messiah was coming, and what the Messiah would do, but perhaps hadn't heard the Messiah had came, based on where he lived. Maybe he had heard, maybe he just didn't know about the Great Commission baptism and was still teaching John's baptism. Whatever it is, there was a deficit in his knowledge. Isn't it interesting? Because in a minute, they're going to teach him the way of God more accurately. You know, you can be accurate, and then there's more accurate, right? He was competent. He still had some things to learn. So what's interesting is Aquila and Priscilla, they're Christians now, but they're still going to synagogue services. That's double duty. They've got worship services. They're going to synagogues, but they're going there to try to have an audience, to try to have people to teach and win to Christ. And so they hear him. They hear Apollos speaking in the synagogue, and they're impressed with him, obviously, this eloquent man, what a speaker he was. But I love this, verse 26, because you can picture them listening to him and going, wow, he's a great speaker. But you know, it almost seems like he doesn't know that Jesus has already came. Or he's still teaching John's baptism, and that baptism's already expired. They could pick up on something was amiss. And verse 26 says, you know, they didn't interrupt his lesson. Oh, you got that wrong. You are wrong about that. Who taught you that, you know? What did they do? Some versions say they took him unto themselves. The ESV says what? They took him aside. They took him aside and explained the way of God more accurately. They didn't embarrass him. What if they had? What if this great man, fervent in spirit, zealous, what if they had just raked him? Are you so stupid that you don't know that Jesus has already? What effect might that have had? It could have stunted his growth, perhaps. Right? I appreciate the fact that here's something that needed to be corrected. They didn't say, well, he's so eloquent, you know, and everybody liked, we won't say anything. Well, no. They said this needs to be corrected, but how we correct it's gonna make all the difference. So they took him aside. They both did. Right? So can a woman ever teach a man? Aquila and Priscilla taught Apollos, they took him unto themselves. They probably had him into their home. Hey, we'd like to have a cup of coffee with you. You know, let's come over and let's talk. And Apollos, to his credit, here he is fervent, here he is competent, mighty. He didn't say, you know, what are you guys? You're tent makers, are you? And you, what do you got? You going to teach me something? Apollos, for all his knowledge, was humble enough to know, hey, I don't know everything. And he allowed them to teach him. That impresses me too. Hardest people to teach are teachers, isn't it? Used to talking, you know. Well, teachers have things to learn too. And so here are some members who taught the preacher. They took him aside, right? And how thankful we ought to be that they did. So what's Apollos do next? Well, he was just a chip off the old block, just like Aquila and Priscilla. What's he do? Because he's in Ephesus, right? This is where they hear him in the synagogue. And you know they wanted him to stay. You know they wanted him to stay. But Apollos says, no, I think I'm going to take off. Apollos goes all the way back across the 250 miles, across the Aegean Sea, and he goes to Corinth. He goes back to Achaia. Achaia is the southern part of Greece, and that's again where Corinth and Athens are found. But the brethren, you know, I don't know why they just didn't Facebook them or, you know, tweet about it. They could have tweeted and saved them all. But they didn't Facebook them. They just sent him a letter of recommendation. They did that in the old days, right? They sent him a letter of commendation. So when he came to, who are you? We don't know who you are. Well, who had lived in Corinth? Who had lived in Corinth and had a church meeting in their house, right? Although that was in Ephesus. Aquila and Priscilla. Well, don't you know having their name on the letter when he arrived and says, well, I'm Apollos, I've got a letter, and they read this letter and it's Aquila and Priscilla, they know him. They know him. Don't you know that would have opened some doors for him? Now notice what he did when he finally came to Corinth. Luke says that he mightily helped the Christians there. He was a great help because what did he do? He publicly refuted the Jews. He debated publicly with them, and he showed them from the Scriptures that the Christ was Jesus. And I made a note in my notes. Look at verse 5 and look at verse 28. Paul and Apollos were preaching the same gospel, weren't they? What was Paul preaching? The Christ is Jesus, which is the same thing as saying Jesus is the Christ. What was Apollos preaching in verse 28? The Christ is Jesus. Some people in Corinth decided they were going to have a preference between Paul and Apollos. Paul was apparently very simple in his presentation. Paul said, when I came to you, I did not come with excellency of speech and with wisdom of words. I was with you in fear and trembling. So Paul was the plain speaker, and Apollos perhaps was known, some believe, for his flowery rhetoric, that he was a great speaker, and so some people were drawn to him because he was such a captivating speaker, but others were, you know, they liked Paul's style more. But no, Paul says, who was Paul and who was Apollos? We're just ministers, right? I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. But here's the most important thing. They were preaching the same message. The Christ is Jesus, and so Apollos was a huge help. Now, what's interesting was, where had Apollos come from? Right. Well, he came from Africa, but where had he been before he went to Corinth? He'd been in Ephesus, right? Well, in the very next chapter, Acts 19, we're about to meet some men from where? Ephesus. And what was wrong with them? They had a deficit in their knowledge. What about John's baptism, right? Have you received the Holy Spirit since you believed? They said, we have not even heard whether there be any Holy Spirit. And Paul says, into what then were you baptized? And they said, into John's baptism. Right? Well, who had been teaching there in Ephesus? Right? Isn't it just possible that Apollos had, you know, he's very zealous. Apollos had possibly taught these men, right? Taught them, in this case, incorrectly. These men were rebaptized. Why wasn't Apollos rebaptized? Well, we're not told that he was rebaptized, I agree. Most likely, Apollos was baptized with John's baptism while it was still valid. Mark 1:4 says it was for the remission of sins. There's no need to be rebaptized. You're only baptized once, scripturally, right? So if Apollos was baptized with John's baptism, you know, before Great Commission baptism came into effect, Apollos was good. Now, if he was teaching John's baptism after it had expired, then that's not right. But he's not got to be rebaptized. He's just got to fix his teaching. Now, if he goes off and meets some people and teaches them John's baptism, which was incorrect, and then they submit to John's baptism, which was outmoded, now they've not only got to be taught, Apollos just had to be taught. These men had to be taught, and they had to be rebaptized. And it's just possible that Apollos' influence there had played a role in that. And there comes Jack into the auditorium, so whenever the preacher's kid flops onto his mom, that's the end of class. That's what my grandma always said. When your kid flops on your wife, you just end the list. Next week, Lord willing, we're going to look at Acts chapter 19. So I appreciate you being here tonight, and I look forward to studying together with you next week. Thank you.